Sean Hughes.
Off the radar.
Right, so here we are in a basement, a dungeon. It's a place where we do podcasts. I'm Sean Hughes. They said, come and do a podcast. And everyone else seems to be doing one. And I'm always
help,
maybe...
Help!
Yeah, I've got someone's been kidnapped.
Help!
I'll get to him in a second. I was hoping to do an intro first, but this is Paul Tonkinson, who's co-hosting today with me.
I would say you're hosting and I'm sort of here.
Well, yeah, co-hosting. Yeah.
That's the way I understood it. Was I would say you've got the lectern. I would say you're essentially hosting.
I was hoping to host, but you just brought in straight away.
I was giving it flavour. That was the flavour that I'll be offering.
That was the gravy.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Amajoy, for coming
in.
Great
to be here. Hey, Tonks. Good to see you.
Well. Basically, what I want, this is what the podcast is, in theory, is middle-aged men, mainly, baffled with life. Let's start off with all the big issues, and straight away is... They tell you to turn off your phone on the plane, but it's not going to crash the plane, is it?
Of course not.
Well, it's the same with the phone thing at the petrol station. Now, isn't the figures of people who've actually hurt themselves by being on the phone when they're filling up the car with petrol is infinitesimally low. It's something like one person wants to set themselves... Because the theory is you're going to set yourself on fire, isn't it?
How?
You're filling your three-wheeler, whatever, your beamer, up with petrol. And the theory is there's some sort of wave, some sort of inflammable thing coming off the mobile. Have you never seen... You must have seen that.
Well, I know they say don't use a mobile.
It's massively frowned. They don't say don't. They go mental. If you try filling up your car on the phone, they go absolutely mental. But no one's ever hurt themselves. It's virtually impossible to hurt yourself.
What, they set fire to themselves, what?
Yeah, that's the idea is that you'll set fire to yourself.
If you're on the phone, you're clumsy, you might just throw a lighter out.
I don't know what it is. But it's just one of those things. They're way too paranoid, aren't they? Of course.
We should do a sketch. I've wanted a sketch would be great that after a plane's landed and a lot of people switch the phones off. Switch the phones on.
Yes.
Just as it's taxiing the plane, just kind of goes. just collapses.
Just goes.
But it was just because I remember that brilliant film about the hijackers on September the 9th, whatever.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Flight 93. Yeah.
And they were on the phone.
Yeah.
I was going, well, maybe it wasn't terrorists. That's maybe what crashed the plane because they were all on the phones. No.
Swings around that, isn't it? You've got 10 minutes to live, but you're allowed to use your phone. I mean, it's one of those.
Actually, there were satellite phones, and I rang my wife on one of those, and she absolutely freaked. She goes, "How are you calling?" I said, "I'm calling from the plane." "What's going on? What's happening? Is there terrorists?" I said, No. And we got cut off. It took me half an hour to call. It cost like £4 for me to tell her I was on a plane.
That's
it was
a rush, though,
terrible.
Isn't it?
£17 if you have peanuts worth it. But that's the thing. So, like, we were briefly talking about technology. Are you technophobic, or are you up there with
a little bit of a technophobia? I'm not very good. I've got kids who are like 17 and 20 who know everything.
So they're all
open. Apparently Paul kids are a bit thick.
My kids are great with it, but I'm just a little bit behind the times with them. They're constantly nicking my phones and all that. I mean, my youngest son is 10. He's just like crazy with computers. He's editing his own films and videos. I mean, he's mental with it. They've grown up within it, haven't they? They're going to be completely different. We've got no idea what the effects are going to be of that.
I had a friend of mine who was about 15, he's in front of my 17-year-old. He goes, "Hey, you know you can get these apps on the iPhone?" I went, "Yeah." He goes, "There's one where if you hear a piece of music that you like, you don't know what it is, just press the app and it'll tell you what the song is."
Yeah.
And I was going, "That's amazing." And my 17 was just laughing his head off. He's like, "You never heard of this stuff?" I said, "No, this is unbelievable."
That happens. Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah.
I thought it was incredible, but he said, "No, I've heard of that 5 years
ago."
No,
that's been around for ages. I mean, I've heard of that.
Now we know where we are in the pecking order here.
Because that's the thing. Like, I never look at an app store. I never go, do you ever?
No.
Because they're constantly... Because I got my first iPod recently, a Shuffle, just a small one. That kind of makes a bit of sense that I can go around with a thing that's, you know, the size of a thumb rather than like going out with all my CDs.
Yeah.
But there's something that doesn't really sit well with just having all my stuff
in one little thing.
Yeah. Are you good with that?
We used to save up for ages to buy a single, didn't we?
Yeah.
That was the magic of it, wasn't it? The vinyl. And this lot, they don't want to.
They don't want to pay for anything.
The young kids, they won't be paying for this, Sean.
They know the cost.
But they know it costs. Well, you know, it didn't cost me nothing to get it, but they want everything, but they don't want to pay for it. We saved for weeks to buy a single, and then we went down and paid like whatever it was and came back, and it was we venerated this possession. Yeah. There was a ritual about it, wasn't
but
there?
But it's not even about the vinyl, it's about the saving up, you know? Because I don't want those people going, oh, yeah, it sounds so much better on vinyl. That's kind of a nonsense. Digital is a good sound, but it is the anticipation. Like, still, one of my biggest highlights, and I know you're both football fans, my biggest highlights of the summer was when Shoot magazine brought out the table tabs.
Yes, exactly.
Do you remember that?
Yes,
I used to wait all summer.
The table tabs? What were the table tabs?
Yeah, so they kind of got up where you got those tiny little cardboard things where your team is on it, so you can put the tables for the first 3 weeks before they... Because remember...
Cause Palace are always at the... Always
leave
the
it. All the papers where you had it up. But
is that... Did Palace get one? Did they always get one, Palace?
Yeah, but they did the whole... All the
team of the 80s.
But they were, actually.
But it's that thing of... Because, again, even with the newspapers didn't show the tables for the first 3 weeks.
Right.
Because it just went, it's not worth showing.
Yeah, now it's after one game they show tables.
It's after the first 5 minutes. Here's a table after 5 minutes. So that's the thing. Things are happening too quick, and I think...
Do you know something? I realised how far behind the times... You know, have you ever done that Celebrity Millionaire? Who wants to be a millionaire?
No.
And you always think the first questions are unbelievably easy.
Mm.
And whenever you watch it, you always know the first couple of questions.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I was on with Bear Grylls, and we did a practice one. You do a practice one.
Mm.
And the first question, and they said, what's the most popular app? And these four things came up. I didn't know any of them. And he went, huh. And I went, do you know what? I don't know what it is. He went, have a guess. I said, I don't know. Because it's Angry Birds. I said, I've never heard of that.
And Bear just ran out of the woods.
Well, he just said, can I get another partner? This is ridiculous. I don't want this stupid guy.
Why would you know that, though?
Would I know what Angry Birds is?
Everyone knows Angry Birds.
But why would everyone know that?
Knows literally nothing about computers.
Well, that's what someone said. If you don't know Angry Birds, then you know nothing.
Well, what were the other three options?
I didn't know what they were. I only remember Angry Birds.
Well, then, come on, that's a hint. That could be the one.
No, but you didn't know Angry Birds either.
I didn't know Angry Birds either. Yeah. So I didn't know any of them. So I only remember Angry Birds because they said that. Come on. And then they, as you just said now, because if you don't know Angry Birds, you don't know anything. About anything in my life? Because you don't know anything. Bear Grylls was nervous. Can I change my partner? That's the first thing he said. Seriously.
Even Grylls got scared.
But, so why were you with him, though?
They pair you up with people.
So, but you didn't know him before or anything?
I never met him before. He never met me. And I don't think we'll ever do it again. We actually lost. We lost on a question. Actually, it was his fault. Basically, they said, what is the price of a first class stamp? Is it 30p, 50p, 60p, or 70p? And he went, I know this. He goes, I know this. I just sent out a whole bunch of... I know it. It's definitely 50p because my wife and I, we sent them. They said, it's definitely for a first class stamp. He goes, it's 50p. He goes, is that your final answer? And I said, this guy kills insects. I've got to go with it.
He goes,
it's the wrong answer. That's second class. And we went from like 20,000 down to nothing. We left. And I said, the hell? This guy eats. He eats insects. He doesn't know the price of a stamp. Well, so we fell out. I mean, I've never spoken to him since that moment.
I think it was awful, but I don't see the correlation between he eats insects and he shouldn't know the price of stamps.
But he's always the jungle running around.
He's a practical
around.
Man. Practical.
But no, like,
he's eating the testicles of animals I've never even heard of.
But he's not sending them on, though, is he? I mean,
exactly. He's eating them.
Self-enclosed world.
This is where I want the podcast to be in general. That's why I thank you so much for being our first guest. It's just the bafflement of middle-aged men. And not like grumpy old men, just
no,
the bafflement
of... No, there's no need to be grumpy. How it's things, quite fun, actually, isn't it?
I love being this. Actually, I'd rather be 32, but I certainly don't want to be 23. You know
how old are
I mean?
You, Sean?
47.
You're 47. I've just turned 48. How old are you?
44.
Oh, well,
come
on,
still got it. Still
really?
Got years, yes.
The thing is, this would be an intricate view, Paul, because I know, you've had it, but I just had it 2 days ago where, you know, for no reason, I just went, oh, I'm 47. And you think, see, when that thought goes into your head at our age, that is not the end of that sentence. So I just went, oh, I'm 47. Most of my life's over.
Oh, really?
Do you not have that thought every so often?
I don't, only because I realise that my whole process of getting old, I've gone from unconsciousness to consciousness. I think all of us are stand-ups. We were stand-ups as unconscious beings. We just kind of did it without thinking.
Yeah.
And that's also, it's fueled by ego, it's fueled by ambition, it's fueled by trying to heal the wounds of your childhood that people are watching you. Mm. But you need to be slightly unconscious because the actual thought of standing and trying to make a group of people laugh is ridiculous. But now all of us were still stand-ups and we're doing it more consciously.
You try,
we're thinking,
you try and get more real about
what
it,
can
yeah,
I honest, do to genuinely authentic. Entertain, educate and elevate an audience?
Because if you were conscious when you started, you probably wouldn't have the brute yeah. determination that you need.
Exactly.
I mean, I remember gigging with you in, like, Watford Jonglers and we'd be together and it's like, they're tough, big old room. You need to be pretty crazy to just get out there and give it all, don't you? I mean, you need to be determined. You need to...
Exactly. And I have to say, Paul was my... When I first started doing stand-up, I was so... impressed by specifically Paul Tonkinson because he was so skillful with his, you know, accents and his facial expressions. Now I think it's shit. But apart from that, I think...
Well, now I want to drop those and get less and do... No, it's true because
I'm
now...
Joking.
No, but it's now as you get older, you talk about this this thing of wanting to be a bit more authentic and stuff. So you want to kind of drop those tricks a little bit, don't you? And just communicate a bit more simpler and direct and kind of... I mean, which is what Sean's doing.
Sean's show was fantastic. Did you see his show?
What I always love about Paul is, because basically all good comics, it's just a matter of finding a voice.
Yes.
But Paul, he found his ages ago, but he's sped it up. That's Paul. That's
you think, it's my voice, but I'm going too quick.
Yeah, you're way too quick.
That part of that is the rooms you play. And so I find when I was on tour, then I started to slow down a little bit. It got a little bit more texture.
Which I was delighted, though. It was first tour.
Which is great.
Is it your first tour?
You don't want to rush it. I've only been pro for 20 years. You want to give it? You want to let the flavour flutter?
gravy,
flavour. But if you're doing rooms where you've got to fight to be heard, then you can't. The tempo speeds up, and a lot of
I
people do very
you,
well are very quick.
I mean, never
McIntyre's
saw you badly.
Quick, Dara's quick.
Is that probably why?
A lot of people are quick.
Is that probably why? I never saw you die once.
I don't know. I've got no idea.
But so, I mean, you started off acting as well, yeah?
Started off, I did a drama degree, so I fell into stand-up by accident. That was my little cracker. You saw my little cracker.
Yeah, which is great.
I fell into it by accident.
So what is your background then? Or are you sick of talking about that?
No, my background, I mean, you're talking about what my parents actually did.
And what they expected you to do.
Well, my father was a photographer, my mother was a dressmaker, but they were both storytellers. So I think must be in all our lives, we have parents or uncles who were... very comfortable telling stories.
Well, no, not in the slightest.
No, I don't
really?
Know that at all, no.
I think most comics, I think you're definitely on your own, though. I think most comics escape their lives to do it.
Oh, really?
Some might. I mean, who knows? I mean, I'm from Yorkshire, where people communicated progressively less and less the further down you go. So my dad will say a bit, but my granddad, virtually monosyllabic. I mean, very rarely uttered anything. No, there's no way he'd tell a story. Absolutely no chance. Sort of quite inhibited... sort of genetic strain. You know? I'm by far the most effusive member of my family.
Really?
Without a shadow of a doubt.
When we ever had a bit of a do, it was always... Is your wife Irish?
Scottish, but ancestry from Longford, yeah.
Yeah, because basically when we had a bit of a do, the only time we all get together is to sing rebel songs about killing British people.
And so that was celebrational, wasn't it?
But this is what I mean. It's just that, there was never, because that's what I mean. I was surprised, your parents, where were they born?
They were born in Iran, but actually, interestingly enough, on my father's side, five generations back, they were like poets, like travelling troubadours,
fantastic.
Like jonglers,
fantastic.
You know, those kind of people
right.
who
yeah.
travel around in a group who would pitch up. And do poetry and stand-up comedy. This is back in that 1900.
Have you done that? Who do you think you are?
They asked me to do it, and then they said, we can't, because all your history's in Iran, we can't really... The Iranian authorities...
Yeah, it'd be too boring.
Well, no, they said it's...
Too sensitive.
The Iranians are not being...
I reckon what happened was they were just set to do it, and they watched that millionaire and goes, he doesn't even know the price for stand-up.
It was around the same time. Filming. What's
we don't
the point?
Want to have it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
That's so true. But it was. But that's what they were. So
that sounds great. That's
it's kind
amazing.
Of like a natural thing for me to do, because they're all. And in fact, I'm the least animated in my family. I'm like he's the boring one who's like needs to kind of get attention, whereas the rest of them are more.
Because,
confident.
But it is that thing as well. Like we've all where you have those moments where people always remember you from, and because you came out. Initially, and you were always doing that big dance, and you must.
Yes.
When you do the long shows now, do you still have to do the big dance just for people, even though you probably don't fancy?
No, I stopped doing it for a while, and they got angry.
Yeah, this is what I mean.
They actually got audiences turned on me, and they said, "Well, we wait." I said, "Good night," and then they waited.
Where's the dance?
And I came back.
Hello?
I said, "What do you want?" They goes, "I did the encore." They go, "Aren't you going to dance?" I said, "No." Well, why not? So I had an argument. So why not? Because that's what we paid for. And I said, "So how much you?" You listen to the whole stand, he goes, your stand-up's all right. You know? But where's the dancing? So then I had to bring it back.
But it's a gap between who you think you are and who they think you are, isn't it? And you constantly try to marry the two. So you've got to throw them a bit of dance. to get your other stuff out.
It's or a, Godzilla it's, impressions or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah, but, no, it's a transaction. There's no, something about
at,
it.
At the beginning you should do that, but not when they pay to see a show. You should be allowed to do what you want.
But Ruth Omid is a showman, and that's great. That's fantastic. You're bringing joy to people. If you
Paul,
if
he doesn't want to dance.
No, but part of Omid does want to dance, and I totally get that. I totally understand that. And if they want that, it feels a bit precious to deny them. Do you know what I mean?
Well, do you know how it started?
Like, get over yourself.
So I tell you how it started. I didn't know anything about stand-up comedy.
Oh, get over yourself and get on your disabled bike. That's the message from Paul Tomkinson.
And then get on your disabled bike.
I've got to tell you, you'd be interested in this. First time I saw comedy, I was very interested. I used to go to the Edinburgh Festival. Mm. And I kept seeing these posters of Dominic Holland. And to me, Dominic Holland looked like a tall, Oxbridge-educated interest. I thought, I've got to go and see him. Mm. I'd never seen stand-up comedy before. So then I saw this small, dumpy, it's like me kind of...
Dominic,
kind of strange voice. I know him now, and I've told him the story. And at the time, I was doing experimental theatre in the former Czechoslovakia, so I thought I was really kind of intellectual and like doing worthy experimental theatre in Bratislava, which is in the Slovak Republic. And I remember saying, he looked at me, and I wasn't laughing because I remember thinking, is this comedy? This just this guy talking? He should dance a bit. There's no life changes.
I don't think he's ever danced.
Nothing. So I remember he looked at me. He goes, "You're having a good time, aren't you, mate?" I went, "Yeah, I am." He goes, "Where are you from?" I went, "I'm from Bratislava." And he said, "Where's that?" I said, "Eastern Europe." He went, "Is it somewhere near Romania or Bucharest?" I went, "God, no. It's like the Czechoslovakia." And I think I snorted. And then he did a snort and everyone laughed. And I thought, God, not only is he stupid, he's making fun of me. Now, I've told him all this afterwards. Yeah. But I remember thinking that was the most disappointing. Then I asked somebody, why is it sold out? They said, well, he's done some television. Yeah. At the time, I was getting three or four people coming to see my show. Mm. And that's how I got into it. I thought, oh, right.
Was this your experimental theatre or your stand-up show?
I was doing theatre at the time. I remember thinking, oh, so I've got to get on television so people can come and see my show. Okay, well, how do I do that?
But you generated laughter through snorting.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. So him making fun of my stuff.
Well, no, you snorted, and then Dominic snorted.
Yes.
And then like, there's comedy.
That's how it all started,
which led to dance.
So you saw that, and then you thought, I can do... Because I remember as a kid, like, I came over to work in the summers in London, and I knew about the Comedy Store, and I was obsessed by it, and I went to it, and I just went, my ambition is to play there.
Oh, so you went to what, Comedy Store in London?
Yeah, yeah.
And you went every regularly?
Well, yeah, when I was in the summer, I just went a couple of times and just went, that was the mecca for me. Like,
are you being serious? Because my wife took me to the Comedy Store in 94 and said, I think you should be. And I went, there is no way I can do this. In fact, I wrote my diary entry, all the comedy. I went, a guy called Mike Haley was on. He's much better than Mike Yarwood. He's an impressionist. Then I said, there was the Tracy brothers, Mark Billingham. I thought, a bit loud, didn't like them. Then there was a guy, I said, a guy starts off being American, then he's from Newcastle, Mark Mayer. I thought, this guy is a genius. And the last guy, a guy called Coyote, Martin Geiger's, not bad for a working class fella.
That's what you wrote.
That's what I wrote. And I thought, but no, I won't. My wife wants me to do this. I put in capital, no way. Exclamation
I just mark. Don't want the mail to get your diary because I think you could be a big bit. I think you might hate Britain. So what made you start then? When you saw that you were in fear, you thought I can't be as good as those.
I can't be. And then in my little cracker, just to remind you, I did my first because I thought I was getting bad reviews for my theatre stuff. And then I tried it. Went to a comedy club in Wimbledon, and there was an act before doing that kind of beer drinking and puppet can't talk, and there was lots of beer on the ground. Mm. And I wanted to come on theatrically and be like Lenny Bruce, because I'd heard of Lenny Bruce. Mm. But I slipped and I crashed on the ground, and it was a big laugh. And when I came out, I had no mic technique and I couldn't take the mic out. Mm. And I grappled with it, so they were laughing. And when it finally came out, it smacked me on the head and cut my head. So the audience is laughing. As I started talking, the mic had come out. So people say, the lead's come out, you idiot. And I went to, I didn't know where it was, and I fell off the stage. So the audience is laughing their heads off.
I'm being serious.
Yeah, let me finish. What happened was, and this is the time when people were like, Cogs would come on and put his coat up and all that. And then I fell off the stage, and then people helped me back on, and then I was walrusing, I couldn't get on. So when I lifted up my left leg, I ripped my trousers, which were black, showing white underwear. And when I came on, I was all over the beer, which is on. And I got up and I just said, "Can I start again?" And I got a massive laugh. And then the owner said to me, "That was great." I think I did a couple of jokes, which got laughs. Because anything I would have said would have got laughs. Mm. I only did about 3 minutes and I left. Mm. That was an OB. He said to me, "Just do 5 minutes," and I didn't know what 5 minutes was. Yeah, yeah. He said to me, "That was brilliant. I'll pay you next week if you come back." Yeah. He gave me 50 quid to come next week. And when I came out, I did my act, and it died.
Yes, yeah,
and he goes, what happened to the act? And
but I said, he really think you were a slapstick?
He thought
proper clown.
Because Ian Cognito had been there the week before and done a big physical opening. So he thought, who's this guy doing a great physical opening? And then the word got round among, like, West London, there's this new Charlie Chaplin act. It was packed. And then that's why I thought. That's why I thought. Okay, well, maybe I should do some. So I started dancing really feebly.
The audience shapes you a bit when you start.
It does.
Because you want laughs, so you go where the laughs are.
Yeah. Tell us about how did you start off, Paul?
Well, I just did gigs when I was a student in Manchester. I just started doing comedy and just doing gigs and to other students and was funny. Was
tell
funny
a funny
quickly.
Story.
At the university, yeah.
But you're from Manchester.
No, I'm from Scarborough.
All right.
And I was quite funny naturally, quickly. And to be honest, I used to get really stoned and just go on stage and improvise. And people used to love it, just goofing around like a complete idiot.
You were able to get stoned and leave the house?
Yeah. I was 19. It was fine. I could do anything. And then I came to London and tried the same approach and just died horrendously. I thought, I have to rethink. I was quite deadpan for a while. And then I found the more physical I got, the more people started laughing. I mean, I always used to like people like Richard Pryor and stuff, storytellers and very physical and voices and stuff.
So
it feels good, so that's where you go, you go where the laughs are.
So, I mean, you were listening to Lenny Bruce then?
He's the only comic I'd heard of.
Right.
Someone had given me a tape, so I was listening to Lenny Bruce, and he just seemed to talk a lot.
Yeah.
I don't remember him actually even being funny.
Well, no,
I had some things I wanted to say. I thought that's what comedy was. I go and like spout a bit.
Well, he did that famous kind of album just about the court case, which he just talked about the court case, about... You know, censorship and the like.
I don't remember him being funny. I remember thinking, I thought that's what stand-up comedy is, that you just talk. So I'd prepared a set. I think through the gods of comedy stopped me from doing that and made me fall flat on my face.
And I found it
there.
But it's interesting that you talked about, you know, like, and it's more so now, but it's very, actually, I think that's very interesting what you said about people saying, why is Dominic? Because he'd been on telly. Mm. I didn't realise it was still like that back then. Because I think it's so much more like that now. That, like, with the perceived stadium acts have taken all the audience. And, like, if you haven't been on television now, you just have no hope.
Oh, but I don't think he'd done even... I think he'd been on the Tube or something, just doing a little presenting bit or something. It wasn't a huge thing.
Because now it's that situation of, like, there's a couple of programmes which are kind of sanitised versions of stand-up, which I don't think a lot of people don't want to do. And that's the only chance you get on television now. And, I'm obviously getting to that... Like you were pretty much made to do the Splashed for exposure this year.
Well, I did Splash, but it wasn't... I didn't really care about the exposure. I did it for personal reasons. But actually, that became such a huge exposure thing because 7 million people saw it.
I heard you were good on it.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, weren't you quite courageous? I mean, it's quite... It takes a bit of bottle to jump off. I mean,
Have you done it?
What, have I dived?
Have you dived from the top?
From Scarborough, mate. I mean, I spend most of my summers in Rio just diving off the top there. Cliff diver.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, I've never
I was looking at your face go, come on.
No, I've dived a bit, but not to any level. I mean, I've dived as a kid, but I mean, that's quite... How high was it? How high was the highest dive?
The 10-metre board is like 2.5 double-decker buses. So when you jump, it's about 3 seconds. So you're in the air
to die, and you dive.
Yeah, and it hurts.
Right.
It really hurts.
Where does it hurt? Where you land?
Well, you're supposed to put your hands flat so you kind of break. But actually, even if you didn't do that, it hurts. Right. So, but that's the thing. Even if you bump your head somewhere, you realise, I'm not going to go there.
Yeah.
But I took the chairlift up to the 10-metre board because I'm
a
celebrity.
That was
his joke. I wanted to do that. And it's so important to do it because it's that important to be a celebrity on television.
Yeah.
You hurt yourself because you know people might be impressed. But I knocked myself out in the rehearsal on the day when I did it and I landed badly.
Oh my God. You actually fainted.
And when I came out, Frogman took me out and they took me to my dressing room and gave me smelling salts and doctors.
Have you just been racist towards French people?
No. No, but basically, I really was hurt. So you can hurt yourself.
But it's the thing of, like, it's just that distinction. And again, like, we play with the word, but I don't particularly want to be a celebrity. I want to be a well-known comedian. But you're given no choice now. You have to become a celebrity to get more people in to see you do your comedy.
Not necessarily. It depends how you see it. I saw Splash as an opportunity to do something outside the box and to push the boundary with courage. And I think as stand-ups, we're all courageous people. But I thought, will this experience help me be more courageous in my stand-up? And that's kind of happened. I needed something in my life at that point to make me a bit more courageous to go into areas in stand-up I've never been to.
Tell us in what ways it's given you courage then.
Because it was the most frightening thing. When you go up there mentally, it's all about mentally preparing yourself. Like 3 meter board was very high. But when you train, you can do the 5, then you do the 7.5, then you do the 10. So it's mentally conditioning your mind. Because when you first go up there, you think, no way. And they said, you don't have to do this. I said, well, you can screw that. Forget it. But as I was doing it, I thought, actually, I would. And then when you do it, you realise it's just a question of conditioning your brain. So then when that affects you as a stand-up, you think, I want to talk about some personal things, but I still want them to be funny. But I have to jump off the building as we do with stand-ups. And that made me think, if I can do that, I can talk about anything. And then I did a one-month residency at the Leicester Square Theatre, where not everything worked, but I had the courage to fail. And that was great. And through the failures, that's when my best routines came out.
Well, that's great. That really is. But I'm glad you told me that. And so, like, I know because with that particular show, you were doing some of your greatest hits and some of the new stuff. And that's a very tricky one to know because you know, like, you're going, right, I'm doing this bit and it hasn't. Like, I think my general rule is 4 or 5 times before you really start bedding in a routine. And you're just going, well, you know, it's Full House. They want some hits. So did you feel you had to throw in the hits?
I just told them the first half is just going to be warm up. I did jokes about me being my own warm up.
Yeah.
Basically, that, you know, I paid him 150 quid to do 20 minutes. He did 10 minutes of really old stuff and then 10 minutes of berating the audience for not laughing. And I watched him, I'm thinking, well, I could do that.
Yeah.
I'll just do it myself. Do the old stuff and have a go. Laugh, bitch. Yeah. You know? So, but I told them that was the old stuff. And then the second half, once they were ready to go with you, it was all new in the second half. So I think that was but it was the courage also that you need the courage to fail. And all of us, like you and me, talks, we used to do jonglers. And if you didn't, like, I used to get calls from the jongleurs people. If I died, they give me a chat. That guy, Matt, will call up and give you a chat, like, what went wrong there? Well, you know, it's maybe your energy level and you cut that material. We were so scared.
Dance.
Yeah, it was. I had that. Yeah. Can you put the bingo thing you do a bit earlier? Because that gets them. We were more incredible. Afraid. I think us jonglers acts. Cause you, I don't know if you did jongle.
Well, no, I did, but weirdly.
I never got a call, to be honest.
I got out of the clubs fairly early. But I remember, like, I had. When I won the Perrier, I was booked in to do 5. Like, you know, the way jonglers do, they book you in 5 at a time. And like he said, yeah, it's probably best. You don't need to do this anymore. And I think he was kind of happy not to have me on the jungle.
Oh, really?
Because I'm still one of those acts that I've never been a club act. It takes me 5-10 minutes to get motoring. Like, you know, minute sets, I can go either way with me. They can love me or they can go, oh, he's a bit rubbish.
Oh, really?
You know, because it just takes me that time to get into bed into the material. Like, you know, that's why, like, I never use a support act. I just go in and do a 2-hour show, really.
It's harder without a support act, though, isn't it? Because you've got to start the show twice. You need 2 starts and 2 closers, don't you?
Yeah.
You
can have a great first half, and then you think, this is great. And then, you know, you can be 2 minutes into your second half thinking, I thought these are no residual feel-good thing going, you know.
Well, it's more
start again.
The other thing is, like, it's when you have an interval, I don't particularly want to have an interval, but they need to, for, you know, to have a drink and for a night out. But
file a complaint.
They obviously don't realise that you're just waiting in a really rubbish room for 20 minutes, just bored, and, like, your energy levels just drop. Eat a banana or something and then go out and go, right, start again.
Or check your tweets. If anyone's tweeted half-time.
But I know that's dangerous to do it at half-time, really, isn't it?
Someone sent me a tweet, your jokes are as old. Your jokes are so old, they remember when you were thin. And I laughed. I thought, that's a good... Who said that? Who tweeted that? You know?
Yeah, that's fair.
But do you love, like... Because, like, weirdly, this is a big difference. Basically, when I was growing up and I started doing the Comedy Store, all the old heads would go, well, you don't know anything. You need to be in your 40s before you become a good comedian. And that used to be the way it was, and all the good comics were that age. But now that's totally changed, where, like, we're seeing as, like, I don't want to listen to that middle-aged bloke talking on. It's all about the young guys and the young audience as well.
Because are you saying that the comedy should be done by, like, Frankie Boyle saying you shouldn't do it after 40?
Well, that was nonsense. But, like, it is that thing of, it's just that... I feel I'm a better comic now, but what I want to know, like, energy levels, it's very hard, and we're all of an age. Do you like doing stand-up now? At your age.
I prefer doing it now more than I've ever done it.
Right.
Ever.
More comfy in your skin, isn't it? Same here, I do. Yeah. I enjoy the time on stage a lot more, but you know, the kind of the driving around and late nights and all that, that, you know, I enjoy that less. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's one of those diminishing returns thing. But I wondered whether I could...
Paul, he drives home from places like Switzerland.
if I'm gigging in Nottingham for a weekend, I will drive home every night because I just want to be at home. I've got 3 kids and I want to see them on a Saturday. That's more valuable to me than a few hours sleep.
But this is like, because basically with this podcast, it's going to be totally different to the normals because we're not going to have a comic on every week because I it's great talking about comedy, but it gets boring if you just do that every week with people. So that's why it's been comedy heavy this time, because me and you are doing different charities tonight as well.
Yes. So Mencap, which one are you doing?
Homeless.
Oh, well.
Which is probably a crossover. There's probably a crossover
say,
there.
It would be good to put them together.
But so do you only do the charities that you really care about, or you just help out because you're around?
Well, I did one at the O2 for the Stephen Lawrence.
Okay.
That was very exciting. I don't know if you've ever done the O2, and I've always watched stuff at the O2 and thinking, you know what, Chris Rock, he's just doing this for the money. And, but I was watching him as a performer. I think he's made it that it seems like he's in his living room, but there's 15,000 people here. So I was the only comic on a bill of musicians. I had to follow Ellie Goulding.
Yeah,
people. So how long did you have to do?
I just did, well, that's another thing. You're there almost as a filler, because they said three, they said, could you do five?
Right.
And then, they said, you need to carry on.
And they're changing stuff behind you.
There was changing stuff behind me. Oh, so that was quite...
Yeah, that's a test, isn't it?
At the O2, and there were 16,000 people there, because they were mostly standing there at the front.
Right. Mm.
But that was a charity I'm kind of an ambassador for. And I'm also doing something for the Prince's Trust. I'm a Prince's Trust ambassador, so I do those ones. But Mencap as well. Yeah, I mean...
But how did they go with the O2? Because that should have been a nightmare to do.
It was a nightmare until... And I tell you, it really is an ego thing, because when you go there, please welcome Tiny Temper.
Yeah.
Please welcome Ellie Goulding. And I was really worried that there was going to be...
Please welcome...
Who? Like, this fat, old 48-year-old bloke who's clearly 25 years older than everybody else.
I was at the bus stop when it happened.
But basically, it was... I was very encouraged by the reception.
And when
that happened, the dryness in my mouth went.
Fantastic.
And I had gone and done... So I went and practised. I actually did the old Jonglers Camden.
Right, OK.
I went there because I thought that's going
to
be a simple...
You need to know what you're going to do there.
Yeah, that'll be a similar kind of younger audience. But actually, when I got there, it was mostly 14-year-old girls and people who didn't know who the hell I was.
Yeah, so were you able to do any material?
I did. I did 5 minutes of material. Mm. And I stupidly, when they said you need to do more, I had something planned. And I said, of course, Nelson Mandela's still alive. Right. Because you say anything, they go, cheer.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, I'll never forget. And I did my old joke, and this got absolutely nothing. I said, Mandela, when he was in prison for 27 years, his opening speech was amazing. He goes, I want to talk about three dickheads. People say, who? Three dickheads. I said, who's he talking about? Pick Berta, F.W. Clark. Who's the third one? I went, three dickheads. I was in prison. And now I am out. Nothing. These kids didn't even remember he was in prison.
Of course,
they went, okay, please be welcome.
And did you do the dance?
No, I didn't do any dancing. I did some singing at the beginning. And that I sang after. And I thought the thing they wouldn't expect is if I sing a song a cappella. And I got them all singing
along
with it.
Fantastic.
And there was a good punchline which they laughed. So that was good.
Get them involved. Yeah.
Well, listen, Ahmed, thank you so much. So what's next for you then?
It's interesting because you saw me do The Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, which is great.
And everybody in it has got films. Terry Alderton's doing EastEnders.
Yeah.
The only thing that came out of that was I got a phone call from Harry Hill's producer. Said, we've just done Harry Hill the movie, and there's a puppet of a hamster who's from Syria. His name is Abu Hamster. We'd like
That's
you
really
to
nice.
Voice it. Yeah, and I said, what's the story? He goes, well, Abu's only got a week to live. And Harry... doesn't understand what he says. So he goes, Abu, if you had a week to live, what would you like to do? I said, well, I've always wanted to go and visit my family in Arabia. And he goes, so you want to visit the top of Blackpool Tower? I said, that's not what I said. And then his nan says, I didn't know you speak hamster, Harry. He goes, well, I speak a bit of gerbil. And so I said, no, gerbil is a completely different language. And he goes, well, it's all about... I said, no, you say that to a gerbil, you'll ask for chips. For me, I'll bite your head off. It's all this kind of ridiculous. But that's the pinnacle of my career. From Red, it's your Shawshank Redemption to Abu Hamster.
But you will be taking that into the West End, though, won't you?
Not for about 9 months, probably September. It takes about a year. So it's done. And as you know, Bill Kenwright, who is the manager, the chairman of Everton.
I don't know why you're pointing that.
Because he knows.
Then you were talking about Abu Hamster going to the West End.
That's what I thought.
People will be shouting for Hamster.
Paul don't go to the theatre much.
People will be shouting for Omid to do Hamster, though. For you. It would take over the dancing. Do the Hamster.
No, but actually, I saw the play and you were great in it.
Oh, did you enjoy it? Yeah. Oh, thank you very much.
No, but you were really good in it. Because, and also, to be fair, like, a lot of that, they were playing off you as to sell tickets and stuff. So there's a lot of them. You must have felt a lot of pressure on you to do that.
I have to say, I did about 17 major interviews for the thing, and it was all pushed on me. But actually, it was, as you saw, it was an ensemble piece.
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't interested in doing a bit just for me. I was interested. I like a project. You know, when someone says, "All right, we want to do Shawshank, take an hour off the film." It's from the book, which is quite edgier than what happened. And then basically, it's going to be five comics, five actors. It was meant to be all comics, but we didn't find the comics to play the parts we wanted. And it's an ensemble piece. So as a project, I thought that's a really fascinating piece. And it's a movement art piece with those
great,
trucks
actually,
and all that.
And the music was fantastic. Like,
did you think the music? Yeah.
But actually, speaking of music, because the first one, we haven't actually got a theme tune. So if you could just make one up now, I'd really appreciate that.
A theme tune?
Yeah. For this Off the Radar podcast.
All right. How about... So, all I can think of something is doing something in my mouth. I
got, yeah, yeah, you go for it. Is this your impression of when you're doing Splash? when you got out of the water. Come on, we're taking it serious.
Unconscious under the water. We need a frogman.
Yeah, one that we can sing along to. Not okay. Glad that.
So you want... there is a nice Iranian tune, which I really...
Yeah, okay.
Golasangam, chibigam as delatangam, la 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 la. La 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 la.
You've been listening to Off the Radar with Sean Hughes, special guests Paul Tonkinson and Ahmed Jalali. Thank you very much for listening.
Sean Hughes.
Off the Radar.
A Big Things Media production.
Big Things!